Hello, Canadian teen book lovers. Today, I am so happy to be sitting in the same room with author Robin Stevenson, who has written more books than I have listed in my notes, because there are just so many. But today, we're going to talk about her fiction books, her nonfiction books, the fact that she writes for kids and teens, and she has a new board book coming out. Robin has covered the gamut of books. First, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you
for coming on. And you're actually here in town from BC, which is so awesome. I'd like to start out the podcast by saying that with the exception of Indigenous people in Canada who have been here forever, on Turtle Island, every family has a story about how they came here. And I was wondering if you would share with us what yours is.
Sure, yeah. I was born in England. I was born in Yorkshire. And my father's from England. My mother's from Denmark. And we moved to a couple of different places in England. And then when I was four, we came to northern BC for a year. We actually went to Dawson Creek for 1 year and then to Japan. And then we went back to England. So my sister was born during that year in Dawson Creek. So she was the only one of us that was actually born in Canada. Then we returned to England for 3 years. And then when I was almost eight, we moved to Southern Ontario, to Ancaster. So just outside Hamilton, Ontario. And that was the area where I mostly grew up.
Was that for one of your parents' work that you had to move so much, or?
I don't know that we had to move so much. I mean, it was related to my father's work, but I think the moving was also partly choice. You know, we weren't, and a lot of people I know who had stories of moving as frequently as I did were like military families where they were getting transferred and so on, whereas I think these moves were all chosen moves. And the decision to move to Canada was just one that my parents made when I was, I started grade three in Canada, so that year. And I don't really know what all the reasons were for that decision. I mean, I think a big part of it was work, but obviously also a choice that Canada was where they wanted to live and raise their family. Yeah.
So maybe more of an adventure?
Yes.
They sound like adventurous.
Definitely.
People,
they very much are, yeah.
Go all those places.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it hard for you to adjust at that age, or?
I don't remember that move being particularly hard. I mean, I think starting a new school and, you know, I certainly remember not knowing what certain words meant that were, you know, the kids talking about recess and never having heard that word before. And,
yeah.
And certainly being the kid who, you know, got teased about having a funny accent or whatever, but not too, never badly, just, but certainly feeling like the new kid for sure. We moved to Australia for a year when I was 13, so for grade 9. And that I remember being much more difficult. I think that was a harder age to have to move. I very much didn't want to leave friends or the horses. I was really into riding horses at that age, and I didn't want to leave the stables where I used to ride or leave my friends. And then after a year in Australia, which was actually a really great year, I really didn't want to leave Australia and come back to Canada because I had made new friends. So I think that was a more difficult time to move for sure. Yeah.
Wow. So you've been all over.
Yeah. But I've been out west now since 2001. So this is the longest I've lived anywhere in my life by a long shot. Yeah.
And you're happy there?
Very happy there. Yeah. My son's 14 and he still lives in the house he was born in. So he's having a very different childhood. Yeah.
Yeah. That is interesting how that happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have a lot of projects in the works right now. I mean, there's so many we can talk about. I think I'm going to start with My Body, My Choice, which is coming out next year.
Yeah, May.
May, yes. And it's a nonfiction book about reproductive justice, abortion rights. So I was wondering if you'd like to talk about the inspiration behind writing it.
I mean, abortion rights is something I've always been pretty passionate about. Be a social worker and a counselor, and I worked in a hospital-based sexual assault treatment program, which was part of a larger women's health program. And one of the services that the women's health program provided was abortion. And so I did some coverage of that program as a social worker. So I talked to a lot of people who were making the decision to terminate a pregnancy and going through that process. And so I'd heard a lot of stories and knew how important it was for people to have that right and to have that, you know, control over their bodies and their lives and so on. So I'd always been concerned about the issue. And that also the time that I was working there was a time when there had been a lot of threats towards abortion providers as well. And an abortion provider in our community was shot by an anti-choice terrorist. Basically, he was shot through the window of his house. So I was also very aware of the opposition to abortion rights and the threats to choice. But I hadn't particularly thought about writing it until the election of Donald Trump in the States, and thinking about the threat that that posed and how much more fragile people's right to choose seemed than it had seemed in a long time. So I was in the States right after Trump was inaugurated, and then thinking a lot about that issue and talking to people about that issue, including people who worked in that field. And I had actually just decided, I'd just finished the Pride book, and I was really looking forward to getting back to fiction. And I had actually just decided, well, I'm not going to do another nonfiction book. The next book I write is going to be a novel. And then I started just thinking a lot about this and thinking, no, I would like to write about this. And traveled back home and ran into Andrew Wooldridge from Orca Book Publishers in a coffee shop, actually. And he sort of said, well, Pride's doing really well. Have you any other nonfiction ideas? And I sort of said, well, actually, yes, I was thinking I'd like to do a book about abortion rights. And he was super supportive. He said, you know, yeah, we should absolutely talk about that and write a proposal. And yeah, and Orca was sort of fully in support of the idea. So I found myself writing another nonfiction book. Yeah. And it was a really interesting book to write. I learned a huge amount and talked to a lot of really inspiring activists and people from Canada and the States and from all around the world, both people who were active in fighting for abortion rights back in the 70s and 80s and people who are doing that work now, people in the States and Canada, and young people in Ireland who were fighting for the repeal of the Eighth Amendment in Ireland, and just a lot of really amazing, inspiring stories. Yeah.
Speaking of Pride as well, did you have any difficulty in taking these subjects and turning them into kid-friendly and teen-friendly topics?
Not really. Pride is aimed younger. So with Pride, I was more conscious that I'm writing for, that some of the readers are going to be as young as 9 or 10 years old. So trying to, you know, define, I think one of the things that I found challenging was that some of the terms that I wanted to define and explain for kids are really complex. And so, for example, talking about something like non-binary identity, that, you know, I didn't want to oversimplify it to a point where it felt like I was really glossing over some of the different meanings that has for people and to sort of oversimplify it. But at the same time, I did want to simplify it enough that a 9-year-old picking up the book could understand the language and, and, you know, other things like talking about a lot of anti-gay laws in other countries actually being a result of colonialism and laws that were passed by the British. And then again, not knowing, like, do 9 and 10 year olds know that history? And, you know, it's a short book. I can't have a whole chapter explaining that history. So I have to condense it. And so, you know, trying to find that sort of balance between having it accessible, but also accurate and not oversimplified. Right. With the My Body, My Choice, because it's for teens, that didn't feel like as much of a struggle. I just felt like, okay, these readers are older. I can assume a little more base knowledge and I can probably get away with using more complex language and trust that the readers will be able to, you know, to manage that. So it's certainly aimed at a much older reader, sort of 12 plus, I guess, rather than 9 plus. And as for the material itself and the concepts, no, I didn't really find that difficult. I felt like, you know, these are subjects that kids and teens need to have information about and access to information. And really, the more information they have access to, the better. So I didn't struggle with that aspect of it.
I did feel like it was an interesting contrast with the activists who are so young in Ireland.
Yeah.
And then knowing that you're most likely to get some blowback about what you're telling kids in North America, teens in North America,
right,
whereas it just depends on where you live.
Right, right.
So kids, teens in North America could be that same level of activists.
Yeah.
If we didn't necessarily baby them so much.
Yeah. I think it's great for teens in North America to know what other young people their age are doing around the world.
Yes.
You know, there's a story in the book from Madagascar about a young woman who started a information line to provide
right.
sex education for young people because she didn't have access to that information herself as a teen in high school. And I think she was maybe 17 when she started that organization. And so for young people in Canada and the States to get to read about this is what teens around the world are doing and what young activists around the world are doing, I think that's really important for them to know.
Yeah, the sections of the book that say young activists and then they have a profile.
Yeah.
Those are amazing.
Yeah.
Because they're real life examples that teens can look to.
Yeah.
And know that other teens are making a difference.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Do you have any advice for teen activists?
I think not to underestimate how powerful your voice can be. I think, you know, using social media, that young people are really good at using social media, and social media is really powerful. And so I think to recognize that, you know, that you have a voice and to use that voice and to find ways that fit for you, that there isn't one way to be an activist, and what that looks like is going to be different for different people. And for some people, it might just be raising things, you know, with their family or with their group of friends, letting people know that these are issues they're interested in and care about, challenging things that they hear that they don't agree with, and putting forward their own point of view. And for others, it might be, you know, joining a local organization. It might be using Twitter or Tumblr or whatever to get their voice out there. I think there's lots of different ways people can get involved. And so finding a way that feels like a good fit for your personality and how you like to spend your time and what you feel your strengths are, and to know that there isn't just one way to be an activist.
Yeah, that's a really important point, because I think sometimes it can be overwhelming. You're expected to change this huge thing, but really sometimes change comes in increments.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And there's lots of levels. I mean, where work needs to be done, whether it's, and there's a sort of, you know, political level around, you know, funding and access and so on, which can feel overwhelming. But a huge part of what needs to be done is also challenging the stigmatization of abortion, right? So knowing that, you know, 1 in 4 women has an abortion,
yeah.
That's a lot of people. And that means that we all know and care about people who have had abortions and will have abortions. And because it's still stigmatized and people don't necessarily talk about it, people aren't always aware of that. And so I think some of the work that needs to be done is just to raise awareness and to talk about the issue, and that to do what you can to sort of challenge that stigmatization and to break some of that silence around the subject. And I think that's something everybody can do. And one of the things that's been really interesting for me in writing the book is how many people, when I've told them what I'm working on, have shared their own abortion stories that they haven't told me about before, right? And realizing that once you raise the subject and make it okay to talk about, then people talk about it. And I think that's really important.
Well, you'd have to know you're in a safe space
exactly.
to be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be sure of reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I also like how you, in North America especially, it feels like it gets narrowed down into this one issue of abortion, whether it's right or wrong. But in your book, you expanded into something that I really hadn't considered before, which is reproductive justice, which is all about women's bodies and how we value women and child rearing. And it's so much bigger than this one medical procedure that we've gotten hung up on.
Right, yeah, yeah. So trying to look at the issue of abortion in a larger social context
yes.
of all the things that affect people's lives and people's decisions about whether to continue a pregnancy, whether to terminate a pregnancy, whether raising a child feels like an option for them at that time, and all the things that affect that decision. And that it's really impossible to separate that from talking about issues of poverty and issues of healthcare, and how people's decisions are impacted by various aspects of their identity and what they are experiencing. So trying to embed it in that larger context. And then at the same time, I felt like I could make the book 10 times as long because, yes. You know, talking about, you know, access to contraception and talking about coercive sterilization and talking about childcare and, you know, healthcare for people who are pregnant and children and so on. And there were so many related issues that I felt like I could have whole chapters on and trying to sort of keep it focused around abortion rights as the central issue, but embedding that in that larger context of reproductive justice. And yeah.
Yes, there are so many things that you could cover.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
It must have been very, very difficult to pare it down.
And it could easily have been much, much, much longer.
Did your editor help with that? Sarah, right?
Yes. Definitely. And there was so much happening. I think the time that I was writing, it was a time that there was so much happening as well, and things were changing so rapidly.
Oh, yeah.
As recently as last week with the midterms, I was making last minute changes before it goes to final printing because there were certain things that happened which, you know, needed to be reflected.
Oh.
In the book, so
I didn't think of that as Kavanaugh, and then
Kavanaugh is yes, exactly, yes, absolutely. So I did some edits after Kavanaugh, then I did another little brief one thing that had to change slightly after the midterms, and so yeah, during the whole process of writing the book and editing the book, a repeal in Ireland happened. So initially, I had spoken to the young activists prior to that, as they were sort of working towards that referendum, and then reconnected again after and rewrote the section about Ireland to reflect, you know, what had happened since. So Sarah Harvey would frequently be sending me things that she had seen in the news going, should we add this? Should this be included? Should we change this? And I would be doing the same. Is it too late to add this story? And I think that'll happen right up to when it goes to printing, which is probably any day now. So at some point with nonfiction, you just have to say, okay, it's done, it's going to print. And yes, by the time it comes out, there will have been more changes, you know. So I've tried to include a list of resources in the back for current news about reproductive rights and reproductive justice so that, people can have some suggestions about where they can keep track of some of the things that are changing. Yeah.
You had the same problem with Pride.
Yeah, while I was doing the edits for Pride, the U.S. decision on same-sex marriage came down. So that was a much happier thing to go back and rewrite than Kavanaugh, which I really didn't want to have to add. But
yeah. Were you a teen activist?
No, I would say I was in university before I became really involved in any kind of activism. Yeah.
So it came when you studied social work?
No, probably more during my undergrad. I remember getting involved in first year university. This would have been, I guess, the late 80s, around anti-apartheid issues.
Yeah.
And then around women's issues, getting involved with a sort of women's collective on campus and a women's health collective and trying to start Women's Center on campus. And then I came out when I was 21. So, and then sort of LGBTQ activism in the early 90s, Campaign for Equal Families in Ontario, we were involved with that and doing school visits, talking about homophobia again in the early 90s. So I was probably 19 or 20 when I started getting more involved as an activist. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
What inspired you to do it?
I think most young people have a pretty strong sense of fairness. And I think, you know, I had a pretty sheltered upbringing and probably wasn't aware of a lot of the injustices that were happening in the world. And then, although I think my parents actually, you know, I remember being going to middle school, so grade 7. And at the time, the school had a system where boys did shop, they did wood shop and metal shop, and girls did home ec and did cooking and sewing.
Right.
And I remember my parents and some other parents challenging it at the time and getting it changed. So we were the first year where everybody did both, you know? So I think my parents were certainly an influence around those issues. My mom was very involved with a local AIDS organization in the 80s.
Wow.
That was, you know, just as it was starting, as this organization was founded, she was one of the very early people to get involved. And yeah, so I certainly was seeing my parents, or my mom especially, doing that kind of work. And I'm sure that was a significant influence as well. But yeah, I think more as I sort of encountered issues and things just felt like they were wrong or they were unfair, that you naturally want to try to do something about that, right? Yeah.
Except not everyone does. I mean, you can feel like something's wrong, but also not do anything about it. There's some people.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it, you know, and I mean, I think everybody has issues that we focus on more. I mean, I know there's certainly issues which I think are really important, which I'm not personally really active in doing anything about. Climate change, for example, is obviously huge. And I'm not spending my time doing activism related to climate change. And so I think we tend to, you know, I've focused on LGBT issues, I've focused on refugee issues.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you have limited time and energy and you have to decide where you're going to put that time and energy and be grateful that other people are doing work on other issues that you know are important, that you're not necessarily focusing on in a more significant way yourself. So to, you know, try to boost those voices and donate to those causes and all of that, but recognize that you can't do it all, right? So
no.
I think we tend to focus on the issues that have maybe touched us most personally. Yeah.
That you're most passionate
yeah,
about.
Yeah, exactly.
Which
yeah.
is great. Because
yeah.
then you take all that energy to it and
yeah.
you're able to make more of a difference, I
yeah.
think, because you do have that feeling behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's when you care a lot about an issue, it's even though it can feel like, you know, change is slow and things are happening that aren't okay, I think feeling that you're at least endeavoring to make a difference and that you are at least trying to do something, I don't know, it makes life more livable. So, yeah.
That is helpless.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it connects you with people who are also doing that work, which means you're surrounded by people who are, who share some of your values and who are trying to make a difference. And
yeah.
which is a really helpful thing and a bit of an antidote to despair. So, yeah.
Yes, because things are tough right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not to say, well, I feel like we often think that things are tough, but looking back through the ages,
absolutely,
every time is difficult for a different reason.
Absolutely.
It's not new exactly.
That's right. That's right. For sure. And I think one doesn't negate the other. I mean, I think you can be incredibly upset by what's happening right now, for example, in the U.S. in terms of attacks on the rights of transgender people.
Yes.
And at the same time, celebrate how much more visible that community is, how much more awareness there is, how far we've come over the last few decades, you know, and recognize that that progress is also real. And the fact that we're having the conversations and that people are fighting for this is something that wasn't happening in the past. And both of those things are true. And I think, there's victories to celebrate and progress has been made. And at the same time, no battle is ever permanently won. And we need to keep fighting for these things and be vigilant and try to fight against any backsliding and continue trying to make progress.
Yeah. But that's what was so ultimately joyful about the book Pride, was the whole look at the history and how far things have actually come.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not perfect.
Yeah.
But LGBTQ rights have come a long
yeah.
way.
Yeah. I'm actually, this hasn't been announced yet, so, but I guess I'm kind of announcing it now. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a second edition of the Pride book, which is going to be published in 2020.
Oh.
And it's going to be an expanded edition. And it's been really interesting to work on it because when I wrote Pride, this was 2015, Obama was president. The U.S. had just legalized same-sex marriage. You know, it felt like it was an easy time to feel celebratory.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the last 2 years have been rather more challenging. So working on a rewrite in 2018, felt very different, like a very different context to be writing in. And I struggled with, because one of the things that I know people have loved about that book is how positive and celebratory it is. And yet to revise it in 2018, it felt like I have to acknowledge that things have changed and that the climate in 2018 for LGBTQ people is different than it was in 2015. And that there are some real threats and so on. So I really struggle with how to do that and how to keep that very positive celebratory tone and still acknowledge the current context. And I think it's really important that kids don't only hear about LGBTQ issues and identities when we're talking about homophobia or transphobia. Like I really wanted to keep that positive celebratory tone. And what I ended up doing was adding a fifth chapter on activism, and in particular on young activists, so that I wanted there to be that sort of, you know, message of the sort of positive message of positive things that young people were doing to continue to make change. And so for me, that was sort of where I found that balance was to, you know, we've still got that sense of how far we've come and how much progress there has been. I've expanded the international piece. So looking at some of the struggles, like what does it mean? I mean, this book talks about what does pride mean to people who celebrate it, but I also wanted to look at what does it mean to people who aren't able to celebrate it. So in parts of the world where it still isn't possible to be openly queer and safe, right? Where the basic existence is still under attack. And what does pride mean in those places? Because there's people fighting for change everywhere. You know, 2019 saw the first Pride celebration ever to be held in a refugee camp, you know? And so I wanted to include some of those stories to say that even in the most challenging circumstances, people are fighting for change. And young people, as always, are on the front lines of fighting for change. And so to include some of their stories, because they are so inspiring. So I'm really excited about some of the new stories that will be in the next edition, in particular, some of the young activists whose words are included.
Oh, yeah. That's great. That's something to look forward to.
I'm excited about it. Yeah.
Do you find it, Pride was your first nonfiction book?
That's right, yeah.
Did you find it a challenge to go from fiction writing to nonfiction? Do you have a preference between the two, or?
I love both. They're very different. Writing Pride, yeah, I mean, I had spent, you know, 10 years writing fiction. And when I visit schools and talk to kids, I say, basically, I spent 10 years making stuff up. And then I decided to write nonfiction. And like, what's the main rule of nonfiction? And the kids are all like, you're not allowed to make stuff up. So yes, it was a very different writing process. With nonfiction, I really enjoy the research. I enjoy how much I learn. And it's much more social. I mean, with my novels, when I'm working on a first draft, I generally don't talk about it a lot. So I just have these made up characters that kind of live in my head. And it's a pretty solitary kind of process. Whereas nonfiction is all about connecting with people and hearing their stories and having these conversations and networking and people introducing you to other people. And, you know, and so it's much more social. And I learned so much. And I find the people that I've met both through the Pride book and through My Body, My Choice, I've just met really wonderful, interesting, inspiring people who are doing fantastic things. So I love that part. I do feel like fiction satisfies a different part of me. When I'm not writing fiction, I do miss it. The sort of, I guess, the more sort of playful, imaginative, daydreamy part of the writing process. But yeah, so I'm sure I'll keep doing both.
Yeah. Are you able to do both at the same time, have a fiction project and a nonfiction?
I go back and forth. I think because publishing is slow, one ends up having multiple projects in various stages. So I may have a first draft of a novel that I'm working on, but then I sign a nonfiction contract that has a deadline. So then I'm switching gear to work on that. And then another novel, which is scheduled to be published down the road, comes to me with edits that need to be done. So although the idea of working on one thing until it's done is really appealing, it doesn't seem to be how it ever works. I do find I'm always jumping around from, you know, one first draft to edits on something else to something else which is under contract and has a deadline attached. So I jump around for sure.
And then on top of that, you've written a board book.
Yes, which was so much fun.
Oh, it's so beautiful. I love that book. That must have been also a completely different style. Did you find it more difficult? Because what I hear, people assume picture books are easy, but they're really not.
Yeah. I know you would think, oh, it's only 100 words or something. How hard can that be, right? But yes, it's amazing how long it can take to come up with the right 100. Yeah, it was really fun. You know, the board book is called Pride Colors, and it's really the message that I want all little kids or babies or toddlers to hear, which is that the people in their lives love them absolutely and unconditionally, and that whoever they grow up to be and whoever they grow up to love, that they will have that support, that they're perfect exactly the way they are, right? So it's the message that I really just wanted to get out there for little ones. And I loved reading board books to my kid when he was little. And you know, we had favorites that we read over and over and over. And, I think every little kid probably has the ones that, you know, you pull out every night and reread. So I love thinking about that book being in people's houses and getting read to babies and toddlers. And yeah, it was a lot of fun to write. And it was, you know, Orca's so great to work with. Elizabeth Kemp was my editor for that, and she was super helpful. And Rachel, who was the designer for the Pride book, also did the design for the board book. And so finding the images of the babies and toddlers to include was really fun. You know, so looking through photographs, and then you'd find one that is the right photograph, right? And it's super cute. And the front cover was a photo shoot.
Oh,
yeah.
Did you get to go?
No, I didn't actually. Yeah. They just sent me the photo and I thought it was adorable. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's pretty adorable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You do have a lot of variety with who you work with, because I was thinking also you're not just a solitary writer. You also collaborate. You have a new book coming out with Tom Ryan, and you also did a book, you co-wrote a book with Sarah and Harvey, which was nominated for the John Spray. So how do you find that working with other authors? Do you like the collaborative process, or you prefer to work alone?
I like both. I like working alone as well, but I've really enjoyed both of the collaborative books I've written. Sarah Harvey was my editor for many of my novels, and we didn't have another, you know, we'd finished editing Pride, I think, and I didn't have another novel in the pipeline with her, and we just missed working together, so we decided to write a book together, and that was a lot of fun. You know, we chose sort of alternate chapters from two different characters' points of view, and it was a lot of fun. And then Tom Ryan and I were good friends when he lived in Victoria, and then his husband got transferred to the East Coast, and so I was living on the West Coast and was missing seeing him and missing having an excuse to chat regularly. So I basically sent him a text and said, "What do you think about writing a book together?" And that was just so much fun to write, and remarkably easy, I think, in the sense that I only ever had to write a chapter at a time, right? So I would like be like, okay, I have to write this chapter, and then I would send it to Tom, and then when it came back, there would be all this new stuff that had happened and been added, and then I would just have to write one more chapter. So it never sort of felt, and I didn't sort of ever get stuck. I find like when I'm working on novels on my own, often by the time I hit the middle, you know, I'll sort of get a bit stuck and think, okay, you know, what am I doing and where am I going with this? And it can feel a bit daunting. And I always sort of, you know, get through that middle section and get on a roll again. But the middle sections are often challenging. But yeah, this one, I only ever had to write a chapter. So it was a ton of fun.
Kind of sounds like a campfire story.
It was, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It was like a little pairs writing exercise. And you just like had this sort of continual new writing prompt coming your way with this new chapter from this other person. And I think we had some very similar ideas about what we wanted the book to be. Lots of sort of phone calls along the way as we worked on it and rethought things and revised things and so on. But it was a great deal of fun to write. Yeah.
Can you talk about what it's about?
Yeah, it's called Meet Me Halfway, and it is, the two main characters are cousins. Talia lives on the West Coast, and Mark lives on the East Coast. So they're in Victoria and Halifax, which is where Tom and I are from. And they're cousins whose parents are siblings, and their families have been somewhat estranged for a number of years. They used to spend their summer holidays together at their grandparents' cottage in Muskoka, but they haven't done that over the last 7 years or so. And they are reunited because their grandfather dies. And so they all head to Ontario for the funeral. And the two families end up at their grandmother's cottage in the Muskokas together, and Mark and Talia sort of, you know, getting to know each other again. And I don't want to go into it too much, but they end up on it happens to be Pride weekend in Toronto, and the two main characters are both queer, which may be the only thing they have in common, or it seems at first anyway. They don't necessarily hit it off, but they end up on a road trip to Toronto for Pride weekend. And there's, you know, there's some romance and there's some family secrets that they're trying to make sense of. And it's, we wanted it to be our big queer Canadian novel. And I would say it is very queer and it's very Canadian.
When is it coming out?
It's coming out in spring 2020 with Running Press Kids.
Oh, okay. 2020. Yes. Yeah. It's like you say, publishing takes longer than you think it does.
Yes, exactly. It's a long way off still. Yeah.
I have so much trouble waiting.
I know. Yeah. I saw a t-shirt the other day that somebody was wearing that said, make publishing faster.
But that actually leads into something I've been wanting to ask you. I shouldn't say lately because I feel like it's been growing for a while, but perhaps a more renewed focus on own voices in teen fiction is evolving, which I am in favor of course. But we've had discussions before about identifying books that are own voices, and also our conversations have really made me think about how to identify LGBTQ books to make them accessible for the readers who need them, but also for the readers who need to learn more about those issues. And I'm still not exactly sure how to do it. Do you have any advice about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I was at a school library a couple days ago, and actually the librarian asked that question, and she sort of said, you know, I'm torn between wanting to have a section for LGBTQ books so that the teens who are looking for those books can easily find them. And at the same time, I don't want to pull those off the regular, you know, shelves, because I want all the kids to encounter those books when they're looking for books. And I mean, I guess the ideal solution would be to buy two copies of all the LGBTQ books, but given
there
that that's,
go.
Yeah, exactly, just buy twice as many. Given that may not be an option for everybody, I suggested, you know, keeping them on the shelves with all the other young adult novels, but having like a bookmark or a poster or a display periodically to draw attention to those books or to highlight those books. Or so if you have, you know, some listings of sort of books that you're featuring or recommended LGBTQ books, that you can kind of draw attention to those titles for people who are specifically looking for those, but without separating those books out in a way that will make it less likely that other teens who might not necessarily be seeking those out will encounter them.
So a subtle way.
Yeah, exactly. But it is, I think it's a challenge for bookstores as well, right?
So. How would you approach it in review form? Because I wonder that too. If I'm looking at a book that has a main character who is LGBTQ somewhere on, that's more obvious. You can call that a theme. But if it's a supportive character,
right,
would you draw that out?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Blood on the Beach, for example, has two main characters, one of whom, Alice, is bisexual. And it's not in the, you wouldn't know that from the back cover. And I suspect that, you know, and it's not a huge part of the story. I think it's, you know, if I try to write a sort of cover blurb that includes it, it feels like an awkward thing to try to include in a very short blurb. And then at the same time, I worry that there's lots of teens that would really like to read more books with bisexual characters that may not know that one's out there and may not find it because that's not identified. So, and I don't know what the answer is to that. I feel like I probably should have done or should do a better job of talking about that aspect of the book, you know, when I'm promoting it. But I think that is a challenging line to find. Yeah.
I do hope that we get to a point where we don't have to keep looking for these distinctions. We can just read a book and take it as it comes, and learn from whichever characters are in it.
If there was so much representation that one didn't have to seek it out, if it was just sort of, if books actually reflected the world we live in, and But there's a lot of people who do really great work. I think, you know, like websites, for example, that list books. Dahlia Adler has one, LGBTQ Reads, with, you know, listings of books with queer characters, lesbian characters, bisexual characters, and where you can actually go and say, okay, this is what I'm looking for, and wow, here's a list. And there are lots of them out there. So I think there are people who are doing fantastic work to try to, you know, compile those resources so that, to make it easier for people to find the books that they're looking for.
So they are there.
Yeah.
It's just putting them in for reviews for teacher librarians so that they know as well.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate when that is identified in a review, for sure. Yeah. Because I think there are lots of people who are looking for that representation, and making it easier for them to find those books is important.
Yeah. And I'm definitely enjoying how it is becoming more mainstream, like the thought of Tom Ryan's new novel, which he
keep this to yourself,
as, you know, a gay teen solving a murder mystery. Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. That cover. Have you seen the cover for that book?
Yeah.
Isn't it gorgeous?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited to read that one.
You haven't read it?
I haven't read it. No.
Oh.
No, I know.
Yeah, I heard that ARCs are coming out in late November, early
December. Is that right? Yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
So what would you say makes you want to write for kids and teens?
That's a good question. I mean, I loved reading when I was a kid. Reading was a huge part of my life, for especially probably from age 6 or 7 up to 14, 15. It was really very, very central to my life. So that may be a part of it. It's just that those books played such a significant role for me. And I think it's just an interesting time of life, you know, and so much is changing and your world's getting bigger and you're encountering new things and new ideas and kind of figuring out where you fit in all of that. But I really like writing for all ages. I've written some short stories for adults. I've started an adult thriller, which is sort of on the back burner at the moment, but that I was having a ton of fun getting to write about people in their 30s and 40s just for variety. So, yeah, I mean, really, I think I enjoy everything from board books up to adult. I read pretty voraciously in most genres. If I had time, I would write in all of them.
Do you still consider yourself a social worker, or are you switched over to writing? Or
yeah, I haven't actually worked as a social worker in 10 years. So I worked as a social worker full time up until my son was born. He's 14 now. And then I did continue teaching social work and working part time as a social worker for a few years after he was born. But yeah, it's probably been a decade since I've been out of the field. I mean, I think like anything you do, it kind of becomes part of who you are.
Right.
So I'm sure it's still an influence in terms of my worldview and, you know, all the stories that you hear from people and the things that you read, and that all sort of become part of that mishmash of stuff in your brain that you draw from when you write. But I don't really think of myself as a social worker anymore.
You think of yourself
as a writer. Yeah.
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 Do you miss it?
No, I don't. I enjoyed it. I really liked it. I wasn't, you know, desperate to stop doing it or anything. I kind of fell into writing. I started writing on maternity leave because I had time, and had always kind of wanted to do it. And the writing just became a bigger and bigger part of my life. And then I ended up doing that full time and moving away from social work. But I certainly loved social work when I did it. And it was an important part of my life. Yeah.
And it's you're right. It certainly informs your writing, your nonfiction writing, your activism.
Yeah.
So we're kind of wrapping up. I do have one final question. After all that you've already accomplished, what would you say your dream project is now?
Oh, wow. I don't know that I have a dream project. I think I have many dream projects, and I think my dream would be to sort of add a few extra hours in every day so that I actually have time to do all the dream projects that I want to do. I'm working on another nonfiction book about activists' lives when they were children that will come out in fall 2019. So that's kind of consuming me at the moment. But I have that adult thriller on the back burner that I want to get back to. And I'm really feeling drawn to middle grade at the moment. And I'd like to do more middle grade fiction. So, lots of dreams, just not enough time.
So going back to Record Breaker or Summer We Saved the Bee.
Yeah, exactly. I really love reading books that are written for that kind of 10 to 12, 10 to 13 age kids. And I love young adult as well, but I'm right now feeling really pulled to write more middle grade. Yeah, and most of what I've written so far has been contemporary. Well, I guess Record Breaker was historical, but mostly contemporary realistic fiction. Yeah. And I have one middle grade that I've just finished, which is I'm just sort of doing some final edits on now, which is a little bit more speculative fiction. And that was a ton of fun to write. So I wouldn't mind trying something else in that vein as well. Yeah.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us, Robin. And I hope, readers, you'll check out My Body, My Choice or any number of books that Robin has coming out, because it seems like you just have one after the other, which is great. So this is the podcast for January. We're starting off our new year with an activism bent. Hopefully give some people hope that things can change and that we can be a part of that change. And Robin is the perfect author to talk to about this. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And as always, I enjoy talking to you.
Thank you so much, Amy. It was really fun. It's always good to talk to you. And it's lovely to be in Toronto and get to talk to you in person. And I really enjoyed this. So yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Great. And then I will see you in February. And until then, happy reading.